My tea? I drank my tea. My tea too hot.
ASMR.
All right, I'm ready. Let's do this. Welcome to Vintage Lesbians, a personal journey of friendship and queer history where we try to set the record a little less straight. I'm Allison, one of your hosts.
And I'm your other host, Shan.
And together we are Vintage Lesbians. Is that what we say, usually?
Is it? I don't think it is.
Shan.
Yeah.
Fall has fallen. Autumn has sprung.
It's here. There's
crisp in the air.
It's all around us.
The leaves are changing. The
it's cold outside.
Are pumpkining the heck out of things. How are you doing in this fine autumnal season?
Pretty good. Got my flu shot yesterday, so I'm feeling pretty immunized.
Nice.
Against the coming threat.
I keep preaching about getting your flu shot at work, but I haven't got mine yet. And here's why. I have to go somewhere.
Yeah, my girlfriend came with me to Bartell Drugs so that I could be stabbed with a needle full of life-giving medicine. But yeah, get your flu shot. It's important.
Agreed. That'll wrap it up for us. Thanks, everyone.
That's it for Vintage Lesbians. That's our last episode ever. Get your flu shot.
Get your flu shot. If you don't, you'll die of the flu.
Probably. Or, like, you know, people who can't get the flu shot for medical reasons will die because you've spread it to them unknowingly. Get the flu shot if you can. And if you can't, but, you know, I'm sorry. I did. So you're welcome. Also, it was, you know, as we said on our last episode, it was my girlfriend's birthday and I threw a little dinner party and definitely the drinks were very good. I think.
You didn't have to go that hard, but you went that hard.
I did go pretty hard. There was a beautiful cheese board. I was very anxious.
Made a six layer cake.
I sure
did. Lemon curd and raspberry stuff.
Yes.
And beautiful handmade Italian buttercream frosting.
Correct.
And it was the biggest thing I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a giant slice that I've been snacking on for the past couple days.
Nice.
Yeah.
How are you, Allison?
I'm doing okay. CoStar sent me a mean thing this morning, and it's really fucked up my entire day.
What did CoStar do to you?
CoStar was like, are you trying to use people to fill the emptiness inside of you? And I was all like, yeah, kind of. Should I not be doing that? And then I was like, oh, shoot. Whenever I feel like I need people, it's a moral failing. And I've already been feeling kind of alone. I don't know. I might cut this part out. Because I don't like to get a little soppy. The days are growing darker.
The days are growing darker.
And it's making my heart sad. It just hit me at a mean time,
CoStar. CoStar, I feel like, might be plotting to murder me. Because it keeps telling me to give away material objects. And about how, like, what is consciousness, really? And I think they're just trying to get me to, like, diminish my footprint and impact on the world so that no one will notice when I die.
I think CoStar is trying to make me go crazy.
Oh.
A little bit. I feel like tomorrow I'm going to check it and my message from it will be like, hey, by the way, you're a bad person, just like you always thought you were.
You know? That's not. I don't think that'll happen. It's probably going to say something like,
maybe you should try starting a book today, idiot. That was mine a couple days ago. It didn't say idiot, but it did say I should start a book. And I was like, I don't have time.
It does.
I work full time, and then I'm going to a birthday party tonight. That was on Friday.
It's pretty mean.
All right, so you want to talk about David Bowie or what?
David Bowie?
Ooh, so surprised.
I'm not surprised at all. Yes, tell me about Davidson Bowie.
I love my friend David Bowie.
Mm-hmm.
I've loved his music for a very long time.
As have I.
I don't know that much about him as a person, but now I do. Let me tell you about him.
Okay.
was born David Robert Jones on January 8th, 1947 in London. He was a Capricorn.
He's a Capricorn like me.
Did you notice that his birthday is very close to your birthday? Yes.
Merely 2 days after, but also almost 50 years before.
When I said January 8th, Shan's little eyes lit up as if to say, that's near my birthday. His mom, Peggy, was a waitress, and his father, John, worked as a promotions officer for a charity. And he had three half-siblings from his parents' previous marriages. Their names were Terry, Annette, and Myra Ann.
Myra Ann.
Mm-hmm. When he was 8, he began to attend the Burnt Ash Junior School, and he was part of the school choir there. His voice was deemed adequate. And he showed an above-average ability playing the recorder, according to his report cards.
Did you play the recorder?
I remember learning how to play Hot Cross Buns.
Yeah.
But I feel like I never got, like, the full recorder lessons that a lot of people did.
Did you do it in, like, third grade, like, in class or something?
I think it's, like, first grade.
I did it as, like, an enrichment, like, after school thing.
Mm. Can you still shred on the recorder?
I mean, I don't know. I haven't touched a recorder in years. But also, I remember hating it a lot.
Hot.
Because it was super shrieky and terrible.
Yeah, I could see that. Did you ever have a music and movement class added to your school curriculum?
No.
Neither did I. But you know who did? David Bowie.
Whoa.
Davy Jones is his name. When they added that class, his teachers later remembered how imaginative his dancing was. They said it was vividly artistic and that he had astonishing poise for a child. I'm wondering if they would still remember that if he didn't become David Bowie. But I like to think that they would. That he was just, like, voguing it up in the 50s. Around this time, he also began listening to American rock and roll music.
Ooh, scandal.
This is the mid-50s. His dad would bring home records by Fats Domino, Elvis Presley, Little Richard, Chuck Berry. He heard the song Tutti Frutti by Little Richard and said it was like he heard God for the first time.
Freddie Mercury also liked Little Richard.
I was listening to your Freddie Mercury episode the other day.
Yeah?
Our Freddie Mercury episode.
The one you were in?
And you mentioned the Little Richard, and I thought, you're probably like a Little Richard. True story.
But you couldn't say anything at the moment.
Mm-mm.
Because it wouldn't have been a callback yet.
Yeah, no. I can't waste all of my dank David Bowie facts on another episode.
That would be a waste. Tell me more David Bowie facts, please.
He saw his cousin dancing to Hound Dog by Elvis Presley and was hooked. And so he started to take...
Hooked on the Hound Dog.
...ukulele and T-chest bass lessons. And he began to play the piano. He was part of his Cub Scouts, Wolf Cub.
He was a Cub Scout?
Mm-hmm. And he would sometimes perform numbers by Presley or Chuck Berry as part of that group gathering. And the people he was in the Cub Scouts with described it as mesmerizing, like someone from another planet.
When did they describe it like that?
I don't know.
I feel like a lot of these interviews were done like when he was already famous. And they were like,
Did you
know David Bowie is a child? Come and talk to us. And they were like, oh, yeah, we totally thought he was from another. Like, you fucking liars. Mm-hmm. You were children.
We thought he was good at music and very cool and did not make fun of him.
And we definitely knew that he was great the whole time and noticed him as different from the other children. No, you didn't.
David graduated from the junior school in 58 when he was 11, and he began attending the Bromley Technical High School. His art teacher at the school was a man named Owen Frampton, who seemed rad, and he later wrote about teaching David. David was quite unpredictable, he said. He was completely misunderstood by most of my teaching colleagues, but in those days, cults were unfashionable, and David, by the age of 14, was already a cult figure. At this period in my teaching career, I was thoroughly used to very individualistic pupils and rarely surprised by anything that occurred. I mean, he was an art teacher in the 70s mm-hmm, and 60s. Mm-hmm. I guess this was actually the 60s and 70s because he was still a child. He was an art teacher in the 50s. Anyway, I'll cut away.
Well, how old was Bowie?
Bowie was 14.
So yeah, it would have been the 60s.
Ah, uh-huh.
He was born in 47, right?
Math.
I definitely called Brian May Billy May at one point in the podcast last week. So, like, I don't really give it. We're not historians, and we're not saying everything we say is 100% actually factually correct. We're doing our best, okay?
Sometimes, okay, we both have ADHD, and sometimes the word will be right in front of us, and we'll read it, and we'll say the different word.
Totally different word, because we were thinking of a different word.
And our brain will be like, nailed it.
Yeah. And then later we'll listen and go, well, fuck.
Owen Frampton went on to say, "Even when David varied the color of his hair, or cropped it short, or plucked his eyebrows, I accepted his actions as a mean of projecting his personality, and of that he had plenty. I did, however, experience a sense of relief when I obtained employment for both him and George Underwood in advertising studios, and at the time I thought probably it would be the last I heard of either of them."
I think he was wrong.
George Underwood was good friends with David Bowie at the time. He grew up to be a fairly successful illustrator and did several of David Bowie's album covers.
Nice.
And they were good friends.
Friendship is nice.
David began playing the saxophone, and then David and George became friends with Owen Frampton, his art teacher's younger son, Peter Frampton. Have you heard of Peter Frampton?
I have heard of this Peter Frampton.
Yes. He was a couple years younger than them. He was a couple years younger than them, but he was interested in music from an early age. And so he asked his dad if he knew of anyone in the school who was into music when he started school. And his dad said, "Well, there's this David Jones character. He likes to play guitar and sax." And so he said there's the three of them, David, George Underwood, Peter Frampton, exchanging licks over lunch. They taught him Buddy Holly songs, and he showed them what he knew on guitar. And that's when their friendship started to build. And so high school.
So high school is just, like, not terrible.
Chilling with Peter Frampton.
All the time for everyone. Mm-hmm. Amazing.
Yes. One potentially terrible thing did happen in high school.
Oh, no.
In 1962, David and George got into a fight over a girl. And George punched David right in the eye.
Oh, that's not good.
He seriously damaged the eye. David was hospitalized for 4 months and had a series of operations before his eye was deemed irreparable. George and David made up really quickly afterwards. It was just like, "Hey, sorry for punching you in the eye. Didn't mean to break it."
Break your whole eyeball. But I can't believe he got punched and his eyeball got destroyed.
Like, he still has his eye.
No, I know.
But the left eye permanently fully dilated, mm-hmm. and had left him with very bad depth perception. And that's mm-hmm. why it looks like he has two different colored eyes.
Yeah, why it looks like because it looks like one's blue, looks like, and one's brown. And one's,
but
yeah.
The brown one's really just black because of the giant eye pupil.
I don't know how to speak words today.
Heterochromia.
It looks like he has heterochromia, but one is just super dilated.
That same year, after he got out of the hospital, or maybe beforehand, I don't know. I'm speculating.
Yeah,
I'm just to weave a story here.
You know what? It's fine. Tell me a beautiful story. Tell me the beautiful story of David Bowie's life.
He formed his first band. It was called the Conrads. George Underwood was also a member of that band, and they mainly played at school events and weddings.
So none of their names were Conrad? That seems mm-hmm. deceptive.
The Conrads, right? When David Bowie was 16, he graduated from technical school and told his parents he was going to become a pop star. And his mom was "Cool, I arranged an apprenticeship with an electrician for you." But undeterred, David got a manager, joined a series of bands, none of which matched his personal ambitions or obtained any real critical success.
That makes sense. I've never heard of them.
Mm-hmm. Around that time... You're killing it. Yes. Very good. That was a very funny joke.
Thank you.
Around that time, David Bowie got very frustrated with his lack of immediate success. He was, like, in his late teens. So it makes sense.
Yeah.
They're all, you know,
everything needs to be immediate because, you know, your hippocampus isn't fully formed.
So he declared he was leaving the pop world to study mime. But he didn't actually do that yet. Okay. Keep in mind.
Keep in mime?
Keep in mime.
All right.
Keep that in mime.
Shit, I'm in a box.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Listeners, you can't see this, but Shan is stuck in a big glass box. I don't know how it happened. Oh, no. Oh, thank God. Oh, you got in.
Got out.
Whew.
Whew. I have to clean up all this glass, though.
During this time, he was still performing as Davy Jones, which was starting to get confusing because there was a much, much, much more popular and famous band called the Monkees.
That had a different Davy Jones.
Mm-hmm. So he's like, guess I gotta change my name.
There's also the locker that would have added to the confusion.
Mm-hmm.
It's like drowning at sea going into Davy Jones' locker, right?
Yes. Yes.
That was my understanding.
Yes. I feel our listeners would know that.
I feel like they would, too. So I wanted to point out that it's not really a locker. He doesn't keep his stuff in there.
What do you think they thought it was? What do you think? Because, like, lockers weren't a thing when they started calling it Davy
Jones'
locker.
Lockers are super old.
Hey, pals, it's Allison. I am recording this later as I'm editing this. And I just wanted you to know that I just cut out about 10 minutes of us looking into the history of lockers. And it was thoroughly unsatisfying. I don't recommend doing it. because Wikipedia just, it doesn't have the information that we crave about the history of the locker. All right, back to David Bowie. I love you. Bye. In conclusion of my little Wikipedia rabbit hole, I don't know.
Hey, will you tell me more about David Bowie?
Yes. Anyway, he decided to choose the name David Bowie. Named himself after James Bowie and his eponymous knife. The Bowie knife.
Specifically. Oh.
That's what eponymous means.
I thought you meant the machete. Or the chef? The chef's?
Chef's knives.
Oh my god.
In 1967, he released his first solo album, David Bowie. Is the name of the album. I wasn't just reminding you who we were talking about. Mm-hmm. It didn't do well commercially either, which makes sense if you listen to it, because it's obvious that he hadn't found his voice yet. This all began to change when he met Lindsay Kemp and enrolled in his dance class. Lindsay's obituary calls him an outrageous and hedonistic mime, which is how I want to be known.
Is it?
No.
Oh, listeners, you can't see, but Allison's trapped in a glass box. Oh no, she found some rope.
In addition to David Bowie, he also mentored Kate Bush, and Kate Bush is a, you know, popular musician.
I'm familiar.
After Lindsay Kemp died, said, to call him a mime artist is like calling Mozart a pianist. He was very brave, very funny, and above all, astonishingly inspirational. In addition to being a mime, he was a dancer, an actor, a choreographer, and a teacher.
Also, miming is hard.
It's super hard.
Interacting with nothing as if there is something there is very difficult. I don't know how they do it, really.
They do it like this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly like that.
We're not going to describe how well that went.
Allison did perfect mimery.
Kemp later talked about meeting David Bowie for the first time. He came to my dressing room after a performance, and it was like the Archangel Gabriel standing there, and I was like Mary, he said. Only he said it in a British accent, probably.
Mm-hmm, probably.
It was love at first sight. Bowie became his lover and his student. He studied avant-garde theater, dramatic arts, mime, and the Commedia dell'arte. Under his teaching, Bowie started to really begin to design and craft his image and persona. Bowie talked about Kemp, saying he lived on his emotions and he was a wonderful influence. His day-to-day life was the most theatrical thing I'd ever seen, ever. Kemp and Bowie eventually stopped their relationship, but remained close. In 1968, Kemp was hired to choreograph a dance scene for a BBC play, and he hired Bowie as one of the dancers and paired him with another dancer named, are you ready? Her name was Hermione Farthingale.
That's a great name.
Right? They fell in love. They fell in love hard.
Ugh.
They moved in together. They started a band together. It was like an acoustic trio.
Ooh.
They played a combination of folk, beat music, poetry, and mime. It sounds pretentious as hell.
Yeah, it really, really does.
Less than a year later, Hermione ended everything to move to Norway to be part of a film, and Bowie was left heartbroken. And this whole experience influenced several of his songs, including Life on Mars.
Hey.
He began to become more and more interested in Buddhism and started studying at the Tibet House in London and considered becoming a monk. A lama there told him, you don't want to be a Buddhist, you should follow music. And so he decided not to become a monk and become David Bowie instead.
All right.
Shortly thereafter, he started his solo career by releasing his first single in 1969.
Nice.
Thank you. That single was Space Oddity. It was released 5 days before the Apollo 11 launch and reached
Space Oddity was his
five.
First single?
His first single of his solo career. So not including all of the bands that flopped beforehand. He's Ground Control
to Major Tom. Can you hear me out in space?
Listeners, if you want to contribute to our Patreon, I'm going to say this. If we get 100 new Patreon donors in the next month, Shannon and I will release an album of David Bowie covers.
Deal.
Okay.
No. If we get 100 patrons in the next month, we will release us doing the seminal David Bowie, Freddie Mercury duet.
What if we release that one if we get 10 donors in the next month? 20. And a whole album if we
20.
Get 1,000.
Deal.
Okay.
20.
We can make any claims or promises we want because it's not going to happen. You know this. If we get 6,000 new donors. Hang on, let me do some math. Yes, if we get 6,000 new donors in the next month, we'll quit our jobs and become full-time David Bowie impersonators.
Deal.
Cool.
But you have to keep being patrons or we'll have to find new jobs.
Yes. And we're, you know what? We're not going to be good at it. Just keep that in mind.
But we are going to do it for 40 hours a week.
Bowie released another album that year, which he also called David Bowie. And it became confusing because his first album was called David Bowie.
Mm-hmm.
And then they eventually reissued it as Space Oddity. It makes sense.
Makes sense.
This brought him a fair amount of fame. He wasn't the huge household name that he is now, but he was still well known. And legend has it that around this time, he went to Kensington Market and was fitted for a pair of boots that he bought from a young Freddie Mercury.
He sold things at Kensington Market.
Yes, boots, specifically. And then they would meet again.
And thrifted clothing, but yes, boots.
They would meet again in about 15 or so years, if I'm doing math correctly, which I'm not. To do Under Pressure. And we'll talk about Wild. That later. 1969 is also the year when David met...
Nice.
Thank you. Angela Barnett. And they were married less than a year later. Angela...
Seems fast.
Or Angie was from Cyprus. And she said that they primarily got married so that she could get a work permit. So it was fast.
Well, that's also... That's fine then. That's good praxis. Mm-hmm.
They had an open marriage. They may not have ever actually loved each other, depending on who you ask. Angie was also bi. She was expelled from college for having an affair with another woman.
Bad college.
Mm-hmm. You know, they were married for 10 years and they had a son together, Duncan Jones, who was formerly Zoe Bowie. And then he started going by Joe because he was like, don't call me Zoe Bowie. Mm-hmm. And then he changed his name back to its original name, which was Duncan. And then he took his dad's last name, Jones.
So that All right.
Yes. There's the whole thing Wild. For that. Duncan Jones is a director. And he's done quite a few projects, but the one that is what I remember without looking at it is that he wrote and directed the World of Warcraft movie.
Oh, that David Jones.
Yes.
Duncan Jones.
Duncan Jones. By the end of their relationship, Angie signed a gag order as part of their divorce agreements, and she is still estranged from Duncan Jones, and she was estranged from David Bowie until his death. The gag order... expired in 1990, so she went on the Joan Rivers show to dish. And initially she got cold feet and was like, I'm not gonna, you know, kiss and tell, so to speak. And then she was taken off camera by Joan Rivers and the other guest, Howard Stern, and got like made fun of or scolded or something. And then she came back on set and told everyone that she caught David Bowie in bed with Mick Jagger. So that may or may not be true. The rumor.
That's wild on three counts.
Yeah.
Like...
But anyway, back to Bowie. In 1970, he released the album The Man Who Sold the World. The album cover featured David with long, beautiful, curly red hair, wearing a dress and boots. He was reclining on a blue chaise lounge with playing cards scattered in front of him. And he wore that dress to interviews and on the street. The critics loved it. People on the street were more hostile. He released Hunky Dory in 71. Hunky Dory is my favorite album, I think.
Oh.
Probably. It has, like, Queen Bitch and All You Pretty Things and Life on Mars and Changes and stuff on it. It didn't do very well at first, but in 1972, the world was introduced to the rise and fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars. It started as a stage show, which ran for 6 months all over the UK. The show started to create what his biographer calls a cult of Bowie. And he says that it was unique in that its influence lasted longer and has been more creative than perhaps any other force within pop fandom. He eventually released an album of the same name, and it was a huge critical success because it's real good. That year, he also performed Starman on the British show Top of the Pops. After he died, like 1,000 touching essays about what David Bowie meant to me kind of came out, and so many of them cite this Top of the Pops performance. It brought him to an even wider audience because at that time, up to 14 million people would regularly watch it. One person wrote, I was 14, unable to articulate what I'd felt about my young gay self, staring at this face looking back at me while pointing and waggling his finger. A before Starman and after Starman line was drawn in the sand. I went into understanding that gender and sexuality could be liberating rather than suffocating. At one point, David Bowie slung his arm around his guitarist when the guitarist came in to like do some harmonies with him at the same time. And it was kind of like a pal kind of gesture, but it also was a little gay. And they say it may not sound like that now, but in 1972 it was a revolution.
Because touching other men is, you know, terrible and gay.
Is it gay if I sling my arm around my friend as he stands right next to me singing into the same microphone?
Fellas, is it gay to have a friend who's also a man? Fellas, is it gay to love you?
Fellas, am I gay?
Fellas, are you gay? Hey.
After that performance, people started seeking out his past work, and Hunky Dory finally got the attention it deserved, and it charted too.
Nice.
Now, he was fully committed to his characters. David Bowie by himself offstage was shy and had anxiety and was kind of described as like a robot. Even he himself called himself a robot. So his characters allowed him to fully give his all to the audience. And he said, "On stage, I achieve emotion. That's probably why I prefer dressing up as Ziggy to being David." But it began to become more problematic, and it began to become more and more impossible for him to separate Ziggy Stardust from his real personality. Bowie said that Ziggy wouldn't leave me alone for years. That's when it all started to go sour. My whole personality was affected. It became very dangerous. I really did begin to have doubts about my sanity. So he retired Ziggy Stardust in 73, which makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
He also did just, like, so much cocaine back then. Oh, man.
Yeah, it probably didn't help.
Yeah. In 74, he released Diamond Dogs, which was completely different from all of his other albums. It had a lot more of, like, a post-apocalyptic kind of vibe to it.
Mm-hmm. I have a question.
Yeah.
Are you going to go through every one of his albums?
I'm not.
Okay, rad.
But I wanted to mention Diamond Dogs because it is kind of cited as, like, a beginning of the punk movement. Like,
ooh,
when
yeah.
punk started, they mainly did, like, the normal kind of...
Like, four-chord
progression. Four-chord, like, pop song, but, like, louder.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas he just sort of, like, put aside all instrumentation and just sort of did whatever the hell he wanted. And then Diamond Dogs was a little harder. And so they kind of let that in as well.
Nice.
It was also around this time when he went from a cocaine user to a severe cocaine addict, which led to severe physical debilitation, paranoia, and emotional problems.
It would.
He started withering to an alarming degree, and he overdosed several times in 1976 and decided to get a little cleaner. He didn't become fully sober at that time, but he went on a tour where he wasn't super coked up, which was nice, helpful. And he moved
to Switzerland. Only mildly coked up?
Yeah.
Okay.
He decreased his cocaine use, and he began painting, sketching, and doing a lot of photography during the year he lived in Switzerland. Shortly after living in Switzerland, he moved to Berlin and lived there for a couple of years. He lived with Iggy Pop as his roommate.
Ooh.
He released three consecutive albums that are now known as the Berlin Trilogy, and that included the song Heroes.
Do it.
Shan, day two.
Yep.
We recorded. We
did our best.
The entire podcast. And then when we went to record it, or, you know, edit it, half of it was gone. And here we are, doing that half. Another day.
I think this will only further our journey to becoming true podcasters.
I think you're right. You know, it's this kind of hardship that is going to make us stronger as people and as creative forces.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Any big changes since we spoke yesterday?
Got my Adderall prescription bumped up a little today.
Nice. Congrats.
So that I can do more, you know, good focusing.
I hope your brain likes that.
Oh, also got more of that good depression drug.
Oh, hey.
Yep.
Guess what I did on my lunch break?
Dunno.
I got my flu shot.
Nice. Ooh. I'm proud of you.
And my Band-Aid has Batman on it.
It sure does. I just got a boring flesh Band-Aid.
They were out of the flesh Band-Aids. And I said, thank goodness, because I was going to ask you for a fun one.
There was something in my brain. Something up in there. Don't remember what it was. So it must not be important.
Are your attempts to try to think of what it is, but not being able to, make you feel like you're under pressure?
Pressure. Pushing down on me. Pushing down on you, no matter what's wrong. And the pressure, the things are feeling down, splits a family in two, puts people on streets. Terror of knowing what this world is about. Watching some young man scream, let me out! But tomorrow,
people on the street.
Da 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 da. Okay.
Do you want to hear how that song was made? I'd love to tell you that story.
Yes, please.
Okay, so we'll rewind the clock a little bit. Queen had purchased the Mountain Studios in Montreux, Switzerland, several years earlier. By the end, they ended up recording 6 albums there. They were there recording an album in 1981. And who was also there but David Bowie? Bowie had just gone through his divorce, and he was trying to figure out who he would be next. Who would his next persona be? Was he even going to have another persona?
Like, having Ziggy Stardust as a persona sounds like, while it helped in some ways, it was pretty traumatic in others, so...
And his other persona, which we didn't have time to really go into, was the Thin White Duke, and that also wasn't great for him.
Was what, sorry?
The Thin White Duke.
The Thin White Duke.
Not as famous, because it wasn't as good.
Yeah.
Super into fascism, the Thin White Duke.
Wild.
Later on, David Bowie got off cocaine and started being super anti-fascist. Nazi? Yeah.
That's good. Mm-hmm. That's good.
Yeah, that's good. Upsetting.
Very upsetting. Jesus.
Didn't know it before I started researching. The year was 1981. David Bowie was in Switzerland, as mentioned earlier. And he stopped by the Mountain Studios to meet Freddie Mercury and Queen for the first time. Now, you may remember, they already kind of met 20 years previously.
With the Boots.
With Boots.
At Kensington Market.
I guess 11 years previously. They decided the best way to get to know each other would be to play some music together. They played with some instrumentation and created the iconic bass line. The iconic bass line.
It's a very good piece of music.
It is. How long do you think it took them to make this song?
Like a week?
No, they did it all spontaneously in one night.
Well, shit.
Yeah.
I guess that's what you get for being super talented.
I saw in your face where it was like, well, we already recorded this and I know the answer. Did I read that correctly? Am I reading too much into it?
What's going to be funny here? And I decided to just give you a reasonable answer of how long I thought maybe a song would take to create. Mm-hmm. And I thought a week.
Especially as one as well put together as Under Pressure.
Yeah, like it seemed like it needed more time.
After they created the iconic bass line, which once again sounded like... they took a break. They went into town for dinner. They drank a great deal of wine.
As you would.
They went back to the studios, and then they created the guitar that goes with it. Do, 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 do. I think if we all sing it ourselves, we'll skirt any copyright laws that there might be.
That, I mean, yes, it's technically a cover, so they can't, you can't get us, coppers. You'll have to get us for something else.
At this point, it was pretty late, and most of the band wanted to go to sleep.
Because sleep is good.
But David Bowie was like, hold on, let me see if I can do a Bowie.
Mm-hmm.
No.
And Freddie Mercury was like, no.
Killed it. Crush it. We need to... I can't do it. I can't do it at all. I thought I had a David Bowie, and then I tried it before Hello, I'm David Bowie.
I'm David Bowie. We need to keep recording.
We need to keep recording.
It's just John Lennon again.
just kept coming out Bob Dylan.
Like, yeah, it's like a mixture of John Lennon.
Hi, I'm David Bowie.
Starman.
There's a Starman waiting in the sky.
That's going to delight exactly no one.
Delights us.
Delights us, so it's staying in.
But David Bowie was like, nah, man, we got to lay down some vocal tracks.
Vocals.
Pushing down on. Oh boy.
We have to finish okay. this.
So they did a bunch of cocaine.
Mm-hmm. So they did a bunch of cocaine about it.
Yep. Freddie Mercury and David Bowie each went into a vocal booth and they each sang whatever came into their heads without listening to the other person. Apparently Bowie and Mercury were both used to getting their way and were friendly with one another, but they also butted heads a lot when they were recording.
So did they, like, do that and then listen to each other's stuff and then decide which lyrics were going to be the lyrics and a little bit combine them? Because I feel like at times they're singing the same thing.
I think they went back in to sing some of the same things.
That makes more sense. Because otherwise, they're mad telepathic geniuses.
Incredible kismet. Brian May was recorded as saying, "Freddie and David locked horns without a doubt."
You don't even know what Brian May sounds like.
He sounded exactly like that.
He's a guitarist.
But when the sparks fly, that's what turned out great.
This seems disrespectful to Brian May and his beautiful mane of gray curls.
The song was initially very, very different, and it was called People on the Streets.
People on the Streets. I can't stop myself.
Don't stop me now. Nope. Okay. Because we're having a good time.
Having a good time. So David Bowie, though?
Yeah. So David Bowie came in the next day, remixed it into Under Pressure. Mercury was pretty annoyed at first. He's like, we had this song.
We decided on this.
We created a song together.
We decided on... I'm not going to do it.
We decided on a song together.
Stop. We can't. We're going to get... People are going to burn us down. They're going to burn our podcast for being mean to David Bowie.
No, I was being Freddie Mercury.
All right, Freddie Mercury then.
And they would also be pretty mad if we were mean to Freddie Mercury.
Yeah, he's a rock god.
I feel like they would know from both of the podcasts we've done about Freddie Mercury and this one about...
That we really, really, really love them a lot.
We really, really love them a lot, except for David Bowie's brief flirtation with fascism.
Except for his brief flirtation with fascism. That part we do not condone.
We just keep telling ourselves he was on a lot of drugs and did a lot of good work afterwards.
Not okay. And he did denounce it. People get to learn and grow. That's the thing about being human, is you're always learning and growing. And as long as you're learning and growing in the liberal direction and the, you know, people deserve empathy and kindness direction, that's fine.
Yeah. I mean, all he said was, I feel like Britain could really benefit from a fascist regime. I mean, who hasn't thought...
I mean, as someone living under a fascist regime currently, I'm going to say that's a stupid sentence that no one should ever say.
Yeah. It does sound like someone who's just trying to be edgy.
Yeah.
Well, edgelord. Well, edgelord Bowie.
You know what keeps me warm at night and helps me sleep?
What?
The knowledge that if our president knew about this podcast, he would hate it a lot.
That's nice. You know what keeps me warm at night and helps me sleep?
A weighted blanket. Yeah,
and if you
good.
Go to gravity blankets
and use the code, we don't have a code,
we don't have
we're
a
not
code.
Sponsored
we don't have we that many take, listeners
we will,
do have a fair amount of listeners.
We have a good amount
like
of listeners.
Like a weird amount of listeners, but
I
not
like all of our listeners.
Yes,
I love them all very much,
except for that one. You know what you did? You know what you did?
I don't know what you did. Will you remind me? Just call me at 252-489
Finish it.
8946. It's not my real phone number.
It's not anywhere close
to my real phone number. That's not even the right area code. Don't call that number, because it's if you call that number, I'll be very upset with you.
We would never know, though, because you don't know our real number, so there'd be no way for you to tell us unless you followed us on any of the
Twitter and Instagram
at
or
vintagelesbot.com. So that is the story of how Under Pressure came to be. And it worked really, really well for both of them. At the time... Just kind of both of them, they rounded each other out very nicely. Because at that time, Queen was at the top of their game.
They were
super, super popular. To the point where critics were starting to be like, I don't know, maybe they're too popular? Maybe they aren't, like, super artsy because of how popular they are. I liked them before they were cool, but now I feel like they've sold out. That was a direct quote from... Music Magazine, 1980.
Oh, I made that up. You're a terrible liar.
Or am I? My name is not actually Allison. I've been lying to you our whole friendship. And
terrible liar. You lie like Duck Newton.
How dare you, sir?
Except you don't swear.
I say swear sometimes.
Not when you're lying, though.
Piss.
Tell me more about David Bowie so I can go touch my cat more.
So Bowie was a critical darling at the time, but his career wasn't going down, but it had kind of plateaued. He wasn't turning as many heads as he used to. And so together, Bowie lent Queen some more of his, like, artistic kind of street
avant-garde cred.
And then Bowie...
Haute couture.
Yes. And then Queen lent Bowie some of their, like, more mass appeal. Nice. And together they've created a beautiful song that combined both of their skills. And it's a good song.
In one big song soup.
A big
delicious
wait,
song
hold on.
Soup.
A big consongration. Like conglomeration, but with song in the middle of it.
Consongration. No, because it's still just one song. Still just one song.
Yeah, but it's two of them. That's the story of how Under Pressure came. It became part of Queen's touring repertoire, but David Bowie never really sang it in the public, except for one time, which I'll tell you about soon.
Do you know why he never sang it live?
I don't know. I do not know the answer to that. Who can say? He was an enigma. The other story I wanted to tell you about Bowie before you wrapped up was the festival he played in West Berlin in 1987. So,
in 1987, the Iron Curtain was still up.
It sure was.
The big old wall separating East and West Berlin.
I remember that, except not literally because I was not yet born.
Same.
In 87, David Bowie played a concert in West Germany, in West Berlin, in West Germany, near the Reichstag, which was the parliament building. Mm-hmm. And it was right next to this big gate, which separated East and West Berlin. Also on the bill were the Eurythmics, Genesis, and Bruce Hornsby. And it was a 3-day concert. And a radio station got permission from all of the performers and the record labels ahead of time to broadcast the concert in its entirety across both sides of Berlin.
Amazing.
It was an open-air concert. All of this Western music was banned in East Berlin. Mm-hmm. But you know what walls can't do?
Because of fascism.
Open-air walls can't stop music.
No, they cannot.
The performance was so loud that a massive crowd gathered on the east side of the nearby Berlin Wall to better hear his performance. Bowie later talked about it and said, "It was like a double concert where the wall was the division, and we would hear them cheering and singing along from the other side. God, even now I get choked up. It was breaking my heart. I'd never done anything like that in my life, and I guess I never will again. When we did Heroes, it really felt anthemic, almost like a prayer." Eventually, the crowd broke into full-on chants of "The wall must fall," and "Gorby, get us out." When the concert ended on the third night, the East German police beat back the crowd with billy clubs and used a lot of force.
Seems unnecessary.
It did. And it was that overreaction from the East Berlin police that turned so many residents against the regime. Because, you know, in any fascist regime, there's going to be, like, the massive amount of the populace who isn't super affected, so they don't necessarily fight against it.
Yeah.
But when they saw so many people get hurt for enjoying music and going to see David Bowie, it completely changed the mood of the city. It would only be divided for 2 more years before the frustrations overwhelmed the wall and it came tumbling down. Mm-hmm. When David Bowie died in 2016, the German government tweeted a farewell to him saying, "Goodbye, David Bowie. You're now among heroes. Thank you for helping us to bring down the hashtag wall. Hashtag RIP David Bowie." It's sweet. Also funny.
It's sweet and weird. Because
it said hashtag wall.
It said hashtag wall. And that was weird. But I get it.
Yeah. I don't really have time to talk about the rest of his life. They were only at 87. He died in 2016. Mm-hmm. Some highlights include that he focused more and more on his acting career. He was Jareth the Goblin King in Labyrinth.
He sure was Jareth the Goblin King in Labyrinth.
And he's known for being Jareth and nothing else about that role.
Yep, he was just a very good actor. Mm-hmm. And there was nothing about it that sticks out in my mind.
You know, his hair was big.
Big hair, yes.
Known for the big hair?
The big hair. And the tight pants. And he was wearing a jock strap underneath the pants, and it gave him a bulge.
What?
A noticeable bulge.
Huh? Is that what he's known for?
Yes.
In that movie?
Also, he does some contact juggling.
Yeah, it's pretty rad.
Which is pretty cool, and he steals a baby.
And he wrote 5 songs.
Well, I guess he doesn't steal a baby. He does take it because... The person in charge of the baby says
Jennifer
Connelly, who doesn't wear a bra the entire movie, does say that she wishes the Goblin King would come and take her little brother.
And he's like, all right, yoink.
Yeah, so.
He also did all the baby vocals in that song, which is a fun fact.
I didn't know
he
that.
He goes, blah, 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 blah.
That's adorable.
He married the supermodel Iman in 1990, and they stayed married. No, he met her in 90, sorry. And then they got married in 92, and they stayed together until he died.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a pretty successful relationship in terms of Hollyweird.
If that's how you Hollyweird. Want to define success.
Yeah.
Did you just say Hollyweird?
No.
Okay.
I did not.
No, you did not.
In 92, he also performed at the Freddie Mercury tribute concert. And he performed Heroes and All the Young Dudes. And then that was the first time he sang Under Pressure live in public with Annie Lennox performing Mercury's part.
Hurts my heart.
Other highlights include he wrote some songs for the SpongeBob SquarePants musical.
Did he really?
Which are still part of the book.
That's great.
And he also wrote his own musical, which called Lazarus, and made it to Off-Broadway. It was.
I think I heard something about that briefly, but
I don't really know that much about it.
Yeah, because no one ever tweeted about it or Tumblr'd about it. So,
It debuted on December 7th, 2015, which was the last time he had a public appearance.
Mm.
Bowie released his last album, Black Star, on January 8th, 2016.
That's his birthday.
Yeah, it's his 69th birthday.
Nice.
He died of liver cancer 2 days later on January 10th.
That's less nice.
He had been diagnosed about 18 months earlier, but he hadn't said anything about it publicly, so it kind of shocked everyone when it happened.
Well, when you live your life in public,
yeah,
you want to end it privately, I'd assume.
It's nobody's goddamn business, you know? The producer of Black Star said that Bowie had planned the album to be his swan song, and then he talked about how Bowie planned his death and his farewell, because he knew he was going. He said he always did what he wanted to do, and he wanted to do it his way, and he wanted to do it the best way. His death was no different from his life, a work of art. He made Black Star for us, his parting gift. I knew for a year this was the way it would be. I wasn't, however, prepared for it. He was an extraordinary man, full of love and life. He will always be with us. For now, it is appropriate to cry.
Hmm.
It's a short album. It's 7 songs long, about 41 minutes, and the lyrics reflect how he was grappling with his own mortality. Unsurprisingly, it reached number 1 in a multitude of countries, including the UK, Germany, Australia, France, Italy, New Zealand, and the US. And then at the Grammy Awards the next year, he won in all of the categories he was nominated in, including Best Rock Performance, Best Alternative Music Album, Best Rock Song, and then a couple technical ones. They were also the first music categories he ever won as a Grammy. He had won a couple Grammys beforehand. He got Best Music Video in 85. He had The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust inducted into the Hall of Fame in 99, and he got a Lifetime Achievement Award in 2006. But he never was rewarded for his music
Dang.
Until posthumously.
I think he probably won because he was dead. Like, let's be real.
Like, almost certainly, it's not his best album. Like, it's not a bad album, but, like, you know, you get it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do I? Yeah, I do.
And, like, we didn't know when he died at the beginning of 2016 to pace ourselves for all of the celebrity deaths that would happen that year.
I don't even remember 2016, really.
It was a bad year.
It's been a bad 4 years.
Were there any, like, big events in 2016 that happened to make it happen? Probably the death of David Bowie.
Probably definitely the death of David Bowie.
I wanted to talk a little bit more about how he actually identified. In 1972, Bowie said that he was gay. In a 76 interview, he said, "It's true, I am bisexual, but I can't deny that I've used that fact very well. I suppose it's the best thing that's ever happened to me." In 83, Bowie said that he was a closet heterosexual, and that he regretted coming out as bi, saying it was, quote, the biggest mistake I ever made. He was asked about that again in 2002. The interviewer asked, "Do you still think it's the biggest regret you've ever made? Biggest mistake you've ever made?" And he said, "Interesting," and then paused for a long time. And he said, "I don't think it was a mistake in Europe, but it was a lot tougher in America. I had no problem with people knowing I was bisexual, but I had no inclination to hold any banners nor to be a representation of any group of people." He said that he wanted to be a songwriter and a performer instead of the icon of bisexuality and, like, the standard bearer for all bisexuals. and that in puritanical America, it stood in the way of so much of what I wanted to do.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
So based on all of that, I do think David Bowie is probably bisexual.
I mean, he was bisexual.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
I think he just sort of, I think Hollywood made it difficult. Because when you're bisexual, you face stigma from both sides. We very briefly mentioned the word biphobia in the Freddie Mercury episode, but in groups of gay people, you're assumed to be too straight, or you're just pretending to be gay, or
especially since he was married to women.
Yeah, and then in straight groups, you're assumed to be, like, just greedy, or you're really gay, or you're really straight and just pretending. It's fucking wild. Mm-hmm. Like, bi women are assumed that they're bisexual because they want to turn men on, quote-unquote, mm-hmm. and bi men are assumed that they're just hiding the fact that they're gay. And it all centers around men. Mm-hmm. Wild.
And even today, in a culture that is much more accepting of bisexual people than they were 20 years ago, there's this weird biphobia around the use of, like, pan versus bisexual.
Yeah, now it's like, oh, well, if you say you're bisexual, that means you're only attracted to men or women because you're it's the binary and it's too binary. And that's not what bisexuality is. Bisexuality has also meant attraction to multiple genders. Mm-hmm. It definitely overlaps with omnisexual and pansexual, and all of those things broadly overlap, and the distinction matters to some people. But the fact of the matter is that there's nothing wrong with being bisexual, and it's not transphobic to be bisexual.
Mm-hmm. The basic definition right now is bisexuality is being attracted to two or more genders.
Yeah, that's it.
Mm-hmm. Regardless of how he was identifying at the time, David Bowie did challenge us to think about gender performance differently. Mm-hmm. He was a white man, so it was safer for him to play with things like androgyny and gender stereotypes and expectations.
For sure.
Which was needed at that time, because we need people with privilege to beat down the doors before other people can walk in. Sometimes. Usually. Almost all the time. Not necessarily. I don't know.
I'm gonna say that while people of privilege have, like, a responsibility to use that privilege to make sure that they're doing, that they're not, like, furthering oppression,
mm-hmm.
We owe almost all of current gay liberation to Black trans women.
Yeah, absolutely. For sure.
And trans women of color. It's, yeah. They have always been the people on the front lines. Mm-hmm. And they're the most marginalized group still. Mm-hmm.
David Bowie talked about homosexuality and bisexuality when those topics were still taboo, and it didn't end his career or hurt his popularity. And one article that I read ended with, David Bowie showed us and continues to show us that it's okay to be weird. You don't have to conform or fit in. And that is the end of my episode about David Bowie. Shan is blowing smoke rings into the microphone. It looks super cool, but isn't necessarily being picked up.
I don't think that it would be, because I was doing it pretty silently. Thank you for doing this research and teaching me about David Bowie today.
Yes, of course.
These were fun episodes. I'm glad that we did them.
Yeah.
I'm sorry that this one is a week late, because we lost, you know, this half of the audio. Mm-hmm. But we'll be back to our regular posting schedule. And in your ears every Monday. We'll be in your ears every Monday.
While we're saying thank yous, I want to give a thank you to our friend Leslie for our logo design. Leslie, you're a treasure. You're a delight to all senses. We love you.
You truly are. We love you a lot.
For all that you do and all you continue to do.
I'd love to invite all of our listeners to leave us a rating and a review on iTunes. It gives us good exposure to other people. Also, good exposure to other people is just, like, tell a friend about us, because, you know, word of mouth.
And then, like, if you told us you told a friend, it'll make both of our days.
Every time we get messages from viewers, one of us will text the other in a, like, giddy, giggly mess, like, look what we got. It's really, it makes us feel good.
If you want to support us financially,
ooh,
you can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/vintagelespod. You'll be able to help the show stay running, pay for our hosting fees, and in return, we'll give you some hot boco.
Also, you get to message us and be like, hey, I want you to talk about this person, and then we'll probably do it.
We'll be like, yes, yes, dear.
We'll be like, yes.
Whatever you say.
Yes, give us your $7. Yes, oh God, yes, anything for $7.
We have some Boko up right now about We're Back, a Dinosaur Story.
Dinosaurs.
Have you listened to it yet?
I haven't, because I'm a monster.
It's okay. It's charming. You can also follow us on all the social media.
The social media.
See, what I do is I usually say the social medias, and I keep telling myself, like, they don't know I'm joking. They don't know that I know that the single of media is
medium. I feel like they know.
So I was trying to just say the social media, but my brain was like, the mediums.
The mediums, yes.
Anyway.
You can follow us. You can also follow us on the social media sites, social media networking sites, like the Facebook and the Twitters and the Instagrams. Mm-hmm. All of that is at VintageLesPod, or you can email us at gmail.com.
That's Vintage, LESPOD.
At gmail.com.
You can also follow our personal pages if you feel so led. I am at Allison Humphreys.
I'm at JustaShan_.
Or you can follow us on CoStar, see if we're fated to be together. I'm at Allison Was Here.
I'm Just Shan.
Thank you for listening. I think that's all I got. Is that all you got?
Yeah, my tank empty.
Any final secret messages to any of our listeners?
If you're still listening at this point, tweet us the word bagel and we will send you a message.
Deal. All right. Well, we love you.
We love you so much.
Bye.
Bye.
And that was Vintage Lesbians. Love is love, bitches.
Pressure pushing down on me, pushing down on you, no matter who.
Under pressure.
I know the words, could you tell?